On this episode of Skull Rock Podcast, we remember Don Wells, and we talk to Pixar's Bob Scott.
Skull Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney, with your hosts, Aljon Go and Dave Bossert.
Welcome to a new year, 2021. And this new year brings a new episode of Skull Rock Podcast. Every week, we talk all things Disney and pop culture with never-before-heard stories, behind-the-scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and much more. I am your co-host, Aljon Go, musician, lifelong Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars and pop culture fan. You can email me at Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com.
And I'm Dave Bossert. I'm an artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, as well as like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also email us, or you can email me, at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Aljon, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Dave. How's your mom?
Oh, my mom is doing fantastic. She turned 90 on New Year's Day. Wonderful. I wish I was going to be there. You know, I was supposed to fly back to New York on the 29th last week and help celebrate her 90th birthday, and about a week or two before Christmas, I just decided, you know, things are getting so bad with this pandemic. You know, the CDC was urging people not to travel. So I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do the right thing. And I canceled the trip and didn't fly back to New York. But I did set up a Zoom meeting with the whole family. And we had people in Houston and Los Angeles and North Carolina and New York, the New York area, all jump on. And we had a lovely birthday celebration online with my mom.
Awesome.
And she's doing well.
Well,
spunky old lady.
I'm sure she is. And I'm sure, I'm hoping anyway, that she had some real cake and not a virtual cake, because
She had some real cake, let me tell you.
Well,
from an Italian bakery in New York.
Yes. I was going to say, because first of all, New York's got the best bakeries. Love the New York bakeries. Love the New York cheesecake. Love anything New York cake wise. And I'm sure you just, you know, had an awesome delivery or something.
Yeah, like she had a really, really lovely time. Both my sisters were with her, and the three of them went out to a favorite restaurant of my mother's and on the South Shore of Long Island. Nice. And the owner, Tom, just took care of them. You know, and in New York, the restaurants are at 50% capacity, or at least on Long Island, they're at 50% capacity.
Yeah.
But at Tom's restaurant, he had he created these plexiglass partitions that sort of are surrounding each of the tables that he is using for service.
That's
and
great.
So she had a lovely time. She really enjoyed herself. So
awesome.
I have to say, 90 and still going strong. You know, she just got a new car in October.
I was going to mention that.
And you know, she drives very well, I have to say. I mean, you know, we wouldn't let her drive if she was not a good driver.
No.
And she is a good driver. You know, she knows
amazing.
How to use the horn and the appropriate hand gestures when needed.
Isn't that the most important thing when it comes to getting about around town in New York? That's really what it's all about. But I was going to say,
How was your New Year's? How was your Christmas and New Year's?
Christmas was great. Christmas was just basically us and the kids And, you know, of course, we mentioned in the last show for Christmas, you know, our cell service was down because we have AT&T, but it seems like they've gotten to the bottom of all that stuff here in Nashville as we try to rebuild our downtown area. But New Year's, you know, pretty uneventful, just watched a little TV, saw some musical performances. It was different, of course, due to everything going on in the world. Typically, Music City is just... We have amazing fireworks, amazing performances from the likes of everybody from rock, pop, and R&B. They always flock to Nashville to put on a
great and country.
Show.
Come and on, you got to mention country.
Of course,
country. You're talking Nashville, you're talking country.
Of course, country. You know, how could I forget, for heavens? But this year was really low-key, but still it was good. But I have to say, Dave, a friend of mine, a friend of ours, actually had the COVID shot. Had the thing done because he is a firefighter.
Fantastic.
And he got it done and he said, you know, it's basically you get a shot, and his arm got sore, just kind of, you know, almost like a flu shot.
It's like the flu shot.
It's a flu shot.
Just like the flu shot. That's what people, you know, there's a lot of people out there are saying, I'm not going to get that a vaccine. I'm not doing this and that. Baloney. I'm going to get it when it's available to me.
Absolutely.
I'm going to get it right away, just like I get the flu shot every year.
Yep, absolutely. You know, and some people are getting it and you can see the feedback and all those things. So yeah, I mean, I think we're right around the corner from everyone getting one of these shots, and hopefully we'll be at the theaters and in the park soon.
I hope so. Well, and speaking of theaters, you know, did you happen to see Wonder Woman yet?
Yeah, actually, we've got a few stories we can get into. Let's watch into it. We could
talk about that, can't all we? Right,
absolutely.
Skull Rock Podcast, this week in Disney and pop culture.
I love it. So we have got what's going on. Wonder Woman, you know, was released in theaters and HBO Max, you know, because we are basically the Skull Rock Plus, right? Skull Rock Podcast Plus. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Skull Rock Plus.
Yeah, Skull Rock Plus. So HBO Max been doing it. And they basically have got $118 million total globally for the film. Really nothing to sneeze at, you know, when you consider how much they've gotten in terms of subscribership to HBO, I think, which is what? 28.5 million, something like that. So
still a lot of catching up for them to do. But the other thing too, when you say 118 million worldwide, I mean, just as a reminder to the audience, there are theaters open, not only in the US, but in other parts of the world. So there is some anemic box office right now. But a lot of people have watched this movie on HBO Max. I'm not going to do that. I really feel like these are the kind of movie I want to see on a big screen. I've always said that. So I'm holding out, hopefully, to see it on a big screen. But it does seem interesting to read that in the second weekend out that Wonder Woman 1984 has dropped sharply.
Yeah,
precipitously.
Yeah.
At the box office, what does that say about the movie?
Well, look, the reviews from the public, and look, let's face it, critic reviews are what they are these days. You can either believe a critic on Rotten Tomatoes, or you can look at the public meter, which I tend to, and I don't know about you, Dave, I tend to look more at the public meter these days to see if I'm personally entertained. You may have a different thought on that. But yeah, like 5.5 million over the New Year's holiday, which is, you know, very paltry, but
yeah, for a holiday weekend.
Yeah. Well, and also considering how much they spent on the film, over 200 million for this film. So they had high hopes, and we all had high hopes. The marketing machine was really on, but because it's been delayed and delayed and delayed, a lot of that synergy was just broken apart over the course of this pandemic, and I think it's just fall victim to it. I think Gal Gadot is one amazing, you know, actress. I think she did great. I love the fact that they brought in some older actors in there. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but it's really great. And of course, the star of The Mandalorian, you know, is in the film as well. I just totally had a brain fart on the name, but at any rate,
but you know something cool. Though, I do have to say, they are fast tracking Wonder Woman 3.
So how do you think that's going to work out? Because as they fast track Patty Jenkins, with Wonder Woman 3, they have the Snyder cut of the Justice League that's coming out soon on HBO Max here in a couple months. How is that going to work out when she is already promoted and signed to do the Rogue Squadron film for Lucasfilm and Disney in the coming years? Because
I don't know. They're going to make it work. I guess I don't know, mm-hmm. but you know, it is, you know, again, I'm just hoping that, the theaters get open soon. Actually what I'm really hoping is that they straighten out the chaos with getting the vaccine distributed.
That's right.
And once enough people have been vaccinated, things are going to start to reopen again. And I really am looking forward to going back to seeing these types of films in the movie theater.
Well, speaking of Star Wars and Patty Jenkins doing her, which by the way was an awesome teaser trailer at the Disney Investors call. That was great. I love Patty Jenkins. I thought she did great on Wonder Woman. I can't wait to see this new Wonder Woman film, but because of Star Wars, a little controversy has been stirred up. Reporting on Variety, and I follow this because of the Star Wars community that I'm in terms of, you know, podcasters, etc. But on December 17th, a popular Star Wars YouTuber joined roughly 30,000 fans as he live streamed his reaction to the season 2 finale of The Mandalorian. This is Star Wars Theory, and great fan channel, and he started crying visually, and I saw this along with him because I couldn't help it. It was on delay, and he timestamped it, and I made sure to check it out. And he was visibly just overwhelmed when seeing Luke Skywalker emerge on the screen. Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! That's what happens on The Mandalorian.
It's a little late for the spoiler.
I know. I know. Right? As you live, yeah. As you've been living under a rock, if you haven't seen it. So he started. You know, people. It went viral. It went viral. He's already the number one YouTuber of Star Wars fans out there. And uh-huh. then for it to go viral, the whole world, you know, watched, and even Mark Hamill had watched it and other people in Lucasfilm. And then you had Pablo Hidalgo, who I own several of his books because he writes for the Lucasfilm Story Group, and he writes the encyclopedias and different things like that, and make sure that the canon throughout Star Wars is you know, very kept in orderly fashion. The planets right. and everything are represented properly, and there's nothing that contradicts anything that has been published. He had published a tweet saying that emotions are not meant to be shared. And in apparently there was a thread of people that were bashing Star Wars Theory, this gentleman who posted it, and many people shared their emotions on that. And then after 20 hours later, he apologized after Star Wars Theory had said, "Hey, by the way, is this really you? Why would you say something like this?" And gave him 6 hours to kind of like say what's going on here. And Pablo Hidalgo apparently had made a post saying he wishes to clarify that his post on emotions that aren't meant to be shared was sarcastic self-mockery and was certainly not intended to be hurtful to anyone. I'm deeply sorry that it was. As a lifelong fan, I appreciate fans expressing how they feel. It's what being a fan is all about. And this was 20 hours later. And wow. So
that, you know, it's kind of sad. You know, I personally, you know, look, it's a free country. People can say what they want to, but you know, to mock somebody because they got emotional over something, you know, that's what film and television shows and really good content does, Al John. It evokes emotion within us. And if it's done well, you know, it's something that touches us emotionally, touches our heart. And if somebody wants to cry, I mean, more power to them. There's nothing wrong with that. And why would you mock something like that? I just, it's beyond me. And if this guy is making his livelihood off of
fans,
Star Wars, and Lucasfilm, and he's mocking the fans. That's just not the right thing. I don't, you know, that's just not the right message that Lucasfilm should be sending out to people who are patronizing their films, their products, their books, their toys, and, you know, merch and all of that kind of stuff, you know. It's sad.
It is sad, you know. And for Christmas, I've received some Star Wars books from my in-laws, and I look forward to seeing those books. I have a collection of Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars books I get every year that I read and I enjoy and I cherish. And then to see him, his name pop up, it kind of breaks my heart, because we're all part of this together. And during this pandemic, we can't see things in the theater together. How do you experience that emotion? And I have to say, I loved watching the reaction videos to Luke Skywalker appearing in The Mandalorian, and I live vicariously through all those people because they experience the same joy I feel in my heart when I saw that. It's just really sad. Just like when Avengers Endgame happened and I saw, you know, everybody just erupted when they saw Captain America hold Thor's hammer, and then all the Avengers started appearing out of the portal. That's the kind of excitement that we want to return to as theater goers. So,
yeah,
it is a sad state. But well, yes.
you have to question the guy's sincerity when he's writing stuff about Star Wars now. Because to do that to a person publicly like that, it's shameful. It really is.
It is. But
you know what? Yeah,
we got one more thing, though. A couple things, really. How about the age-old question? Is it Ginger or Marianne?
Ginger or Marianne?
You'd marry Marianne. You'd date Ginger. You'd have to buy her a martini and take her out to dinner. Marianne would raise your children and help you in the farm.
I know, right? That was Don Wells, the legendary Don Wells. And I have to say, I was such a huge fan of Gilligan's Island growing up watching it in syndication.
I was too.
And I absolutely love the specials. And Don Wells, unfortunately, she, you know, finally succumbed to COVID-19 at the age of 82.
It was shocking to see that she was 82. I mean, she had a wonderful life, but you have this picture of Dawn Wells as that Kansas farm girl in your head. You hear Dawn Wells and, you know, she's frozen in time from the Gilligan's Island TV show.
Yeah.
I mean, really, and just for her to pass away from COVID-19, it's just so sad.
It is. It really is. And, you know, of course, everyone in entertainment, their heart showed their support out there on social media for her. And once again, she was, I think as a kid growing up, you often wonder, Ginger or Marianne? And I was always in the Marianne camp. Always loved the girl next door, married the girl next door. So I can tell you that I'm a big fan of Don Wells. Rest in peace, Don Wells. The last thing I should say too, because you're a fan of The Deadliest Catch, are you not?
I have been watching it for years. I love The Deadliest Catch, and it was really sad to see that Nick McGlashan had died. And he was the deck boss on the Summer Bay with Wild Bill at the helm. And Nick had struggled with alcohol and drug addiction over the years. And it was talked about within the program. In fact, Wild Bill had to throw Nick off the boat at one point. Not into the sea, of course, but you know, they didn't leave the dock. He had to toss Nick onto the dock, and he passed away. He was only 33 years old.
So young.
What a shame.
Yeah, so young. And he lived in Nashville as well. So he was right around the corner from me. And by the way, Don Wells also lived in Nashville for a time. So both of them, the Nashville connection is there. So please rest in peace, everyone. I know that, you know, these people, you know, they grace our TV screens every week or movie screens every week, but it's nice that we can remember them.
Absolutely. And you know what? Let's turn to a happier note. We have a fantastic guest today. His name is Bob Scott. Pixar animator, storyboard artist. He's worked at Disney. He's worked with Jim Davis on the Garfield comic strips and television specials. And he has his own comic strip. So we should jump to this interview because I'm excited to talk about Bob's comic strip.
All right, let's do it.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
Al John, we've got a wonderful guest today. His name is Robert Scott, also known as Bob Scott. And he's not only an animator who's been in the industry for decades, working on some incredible films like The Incredibles up at Pixar, Monsters, Inc. He's also worked closely with Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield, the comic strip, as well as some of the Garfield animated specials. And so it's really, I think, a wonderful pleasure to have Bob Scott with us today. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. Your podcast is great. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much for that. We're trying. And really what makes the podcast, I think, really fun and great, as you said, is that we have fantastic guests like yourself on. And what I think is so interesting about your career is that you started out in animation, but you'd always had this affinity to do comic strips. And I really want you to tell our audience, if you would, how you got started. What were you doing, you know, in your childhood? And how did you get into the comic strips and then get into animation?
I'm probably similar to a lot of people in animation that when I was a kid, I just liked anything with cartoons, whether they moved or they were in a comic strip or the Sunday papers. Just seeing cartoony drawings, there's such an appeal to that sort of thing. I remember being pretty young and, I think it was had to be the very tail end of Pogo being in the paper. I mean, it had to be like after Walt Kelly had passed away and his wife took it over, and seeing those drawings, I remember thinking they had this quality of life to them. So I love that. There was a comic strip that kind of looked like the animation I liked too. There was, you know, so much life in animation and appeal to like Disney drawings. I'm like, these kind of look like Disney type drawings. Come to find out years later that Walt Kelly worked for Disney, was an animator on Dumbo and a few other things, and then went into comic strips. I just loved that stuff. And I had a mom and dad that were really encouraging. My mom, I remember when I was a young kid, I was watching an Underdog cartoon and I asked my mom, how do they make those drawings move? And she said, she tried to explain it to me. She somehow knew a little bit about it and I didn't quite understand. She said, well, tomorrow we'll talk about it. I'll go to the grocery store and I'll get something. She came back from the grocery store the next day with like a pad of paper and showed me with little stick figures, you know, you draw a character, you know, a stick figure here, and then you move it a little bit here. And I just thought that was the neatest thing. Once you flipped it, that this drawing came to life. And so that kind of started me on just wanting to know more about that. And I was very, very young at that point. Like I would have been in probably first grade when.
Oh, wow. Were there any books that you came across or did you look for any books on animation?
Yeah. Once I got old enough to understand the library and go to the library, I mean, I checked out every book on animation and cartooning I could find. There was a cartooning book when I was really young by a cartoonist named Sid Hoff. Mm-hmm. He's famous for a lot of children's books. And that was a great book. It's long out of print. I haven't seen it in years, but he actually taught you how to draw a character from beginning to end and his very simple dot-eyed style. And I remember kind of copying that and trying to draw it the way he drew it, you know, the different steps to do a face or a head or a whatever. So yeah, the library, we didn't have a lot of money. So it wasn't like back then you bought a lot of books. It was really the library that my mom was a school teacher too. So she was actually, when I was really young, studying to be a school teacher at night. My dad was working during the day and she would go to college at night. This was in Michigan. And sometimes she would bring one of us along, my brother or I, and I would sit in the library while she was in her class and just kind of pore through books and, you know, whatever cartoony animation book there was. That was the section I went to. And then later on, discovering the Preston Blair book.
I think all of us had that Preston Blair book. That was the oversized paperback. How to Animate book by Preston Blair, brother of Lee Blair and brother-in-law of Mary Blair.
Yeah, I found that out years later. Definitely.
Very talented family there.
Oh my gosh! Yes, very talented. there was another book that I remember distinctly too. It was a Charles Schulz book written by Lee Mendelson about, it was like whatever anniversary it was in the 70s for Peanuts. I maybe 25 years or something. I can't remember. But there was a book that went through how he did a strip, the whole history of Peanuts. And there was one chapter on animation. They showed them recording the kids doing the voices for one of the specials. They showed a cell painter, the desk of the animator. And then later on was how he did a strip. They showed him in a studio penciling, inking. So the both things were always kind of, you know, I liked them both. I was kind of back and forth doing, trying to do my own comic strips, trying to animate.
And you were doing comic strips when you were in high school, weren't you?
I was, yeah. Yeah, I was sending things out, submissions. High school is probably the first time I sent anything out to a syndicate. And of course, you get the rejection letter, usually a form letter. By that time I was reading Doonesbury. That was the one that really, when I got to high school, I discovered Doonesbury, and I just loved his writing, that the characters talked like real people. It wasn't just a joke, you know. No. And then of course Bloom County kind of took that and started out very much like Doonesbury, but then became its own world and its own thing with Opus and all of that.
Let me ask you, when you were sending those strips into the syndicates, first, can you explain a syndicate to our audience? And then secondly, did it give you any feedback? Did it tell you need to improve here or there, or this is what we're looking for? But tell us what a syndicate is.
Yeah, so a syndicate, and they do still exist, as there are still newspapers out there, but a syndicate would be place you would send your strips to, and the syndicate would take that comic strip, if they decided to take it on, and distribute it and sell it to different newspapers across the country, actually across the world. So for instance, Peanuts at the time, I think it was like 2,700 papers, which is sort of the saturation point, because you can't be in two papers in the same town. You know, a competing paper will have their strips, and then the other paper would have their strips. So getting syndicated was kind of the brass ring. Like if you could get that, your strip could get out there and hopefully get readers and gain a following. And you could, you know, back then, hopefully make a living at it. That was the dream, is, you know, to do that, work from home, do your own thing, mail it out, and it gets distributed everywhere. Now, the letters I would get back then, I don't remember till a little bit later. I think they were pretty much form letters in high school. And by the time I got to college, I was getting better and learning a lot more at CalArts. And then I started, once in a while, I would get a letter that was actually a little bit of constructive criticism. And it was usually the writing that they would point out that I needed to work on. Mm-hmm. And so I always tried to get better at that. And that was kind of the main thing. Then there were years I got so many rejection letters, kind of got a little close with a few things, didn't really go anywhere. And I just kind of left it behind for a while, just focused on animation. Because this is pre-internet. So you really couldn't do much with your strip unless you got syndicated. You know?
Right, right.
So, now getting it out there, you don't need a syndicate, so you can do it and get that fulfillment of actually drawing a comic strip.
Can you talk a little bit about like sort of how has the industry for comic strips changed in your lifetime? You know, from the fact that, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, there, you know, you could be like Peanuts and have it in 2000 newspapers around the world.
Right.
But, you know, in the last 20 years or so, 25 years, newspapers have been folding up. There's right. less in the way of readership of newspapers. The whole sort of newspaper world as we once knew it has shifted because of digital. How has that affected the comic strips?
I think it's been actually good in a lot of ways because more is out there now and more people can get their stuff out there. I mean, somebody can put their stuff on Instagram or one of the websites that hosts webcomics and you can gain a kind of a following, which is great being able to get it out there. I'd say monetarily though, for me, I don't make much on the strip at all. Very little. It's more a labor of love. But there are some people that have, you know, been able to parlay that into, they use Patreon and they use ways to make a living. They're savvy with the web and social media and that sort of thing. But that's the main change, is that you're not beholden to the newspaper or the syndicate. You can get your stuff out there. A kid can start a blog and put his comic strip out there and get feedback or find out, you know, meet other cartoonists. You know, that was something. I mean, to meet a cartoonist or actually write a cartoonist and get a letter back, you know, that was a big deal. Now, you know, I'm sure kids have more access to meeting these people. I don't know. I'm kind of wandering off another.
Yeah, but no, that's okay, because you know, how did you, it's a natural question then for me, is how did you meet Jim Davis, the creator of Garfield, the comic strip? How did you connect with him?
That was, so I was still going to CalArts. It was my last year, but I was doing my classes at night or working on my film at night. And during the day, I was working for Marvel Productions in Van Nuys on Muppet Babies, doing turnarounds and character design stuff there. And my good friend, Brett Koth, who you may know, Brett Koth, he went to CalArts.
Yeah, I believe I do know him. I haven't seen him in years.
But
was he a cleanup artist at Disney for a while?
He was, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, just like impeccable, you know.
Brett's I absolutely do remember him. You said a couple of things here, aside from Brett Koth, you also mentioned Marvel, which always gets Al John's ears perked up.
Yeah, working at Marvel, Stan Lee was actually there when I was there. He had an office. Mm-hmm. And I was sharing a room with an artist there, friend of mine, Tony Fucilli, and next door was...
Oh, I know Tony. Yeah, Tony's great. Yeah, he's a great animator. Tony Fucilli. Yeah, he's a fabulous animator.
Great guy. We've been great friends for years. And next door was Stan Lee. You'd hear him, you know, talking to his secretary or something about something. He wasn't in every day, but you'd see him once in a while in the hallways.
And this is well before, by the way, Disney purchased Marvel. Yeah. This was really back when Marvel was still doing Marvel comic books.
Exactly. This was 1985. I think Marvel was an offshoot of DePatie Freeling. I think they bought DePatie Freeling and they became Marvel Animation. They wanted to do their own characters, but they ended up doing other characters as well. My Little Pony, I think, and a few different things. Yeah, My Little Pony, definitely. So anyways, Brett Koth and I were both working there. And somebody came through who had heard that Jim Davis was looking for an assistant on a new comic strip he had called U.S. Acres, which had just launched, brand new, and was looking for somebody to pencil that. So both Brett and I, we're great friends. We loved comic strips. That was kind of our goal. Like, he was sending stuff to syndicates. I met him at CalArts. I was sending stuff. We'd look at each other's stuff, get inspired. And just, he was like the first guy I met in animation that loved comic strips as much as me and knew everything about every comic strip. So we both, we jumped at the chance. No one else was really interested, you know, and we were interested, like, wow, to be an assistant for a cartoonist. And I loved the Garfield strip. I thought I think the gags are great, especially the early ones. I just love the way Jim drew the character and everything. So we then got in contact. We had to send our portfolios, fax them at Film Roman. Film Roman was Phil Roman's studio, and he was doing the Garfield special. So he was kind of the liaison between Jim and anyone in the animation industry was interested. So it turned out Brett and I were the only two that applied. I don't know if the word got around very far or whatever, but we were lucky to know about this. So we sent our stuff, and both Brett and I got separate calls from Jim himself. He called on the phone. I came home from work one night, phone rang. Hey, this is Jim Davis. And like, I was blown away. Like, I'm speaking to Jim Davis. This is amazing. And he said, I love your stuff. I like your stuff. I'd like to fly you out and interview you to Muncie, Indiana, which is his studio, Paws Incorporated. He's got, well, it's been sold now to Nickelodeon, but that time it was his studio. It was a house in the country that was turned into a studio, and they built like a section onto it and had a little bullpen of artists doing the licensing artwork. And this artist named Gary Barker was drawing both U.S. Acres and Garfield, penciling it every day, which is an enormous amount of work. Even though he's not inking and writing, it's just a lot of
strips
to draw. I heard him in the background, hurry up! Gary's working day and night. And so he flew myself, Brett got the same call. He flew both of us out. He flew out Brett's wife, Mona Koth, who's also an artist, and my wife, fiance at the time, Vicky. And we flew out there for an interview together, not thinking, you know, he's only looking for one person. We just thought, well, we'll see what happens. It could be you, it could be me. Maybe it won't be either of us. Mm. But we spent at least a day there, I think. They put us up in a hotel day or so. We got to see the studio, you know, showed us around Muncie, which there's not a lot to see. It's pretty quick tour. And, you know, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's north of Indianapolis. I believe it's north. And so it's small rural area, which is where Jim grew up.
Supermarket, a bank, and a post office.
Yeah, there was a tire store in the mall. It's weird. I grew up in Michigan, Detroit suburbs. I'd never seen a tire store in a mall, which is kind of funny. But he was really nice. And at the very end of the whole interview, he went off to talk to people about it, or, you know, his financial guy or whatever, came back and he said, we're going to hire both of you. And we were just over the moon. So he said, yeah, I want you both to co-pencil the strip, blue line the strip. And there was a guy who was inking it. He was going to continue inking it. So they wanted us to start, I think, whenever we could. So I can't remember how.
Did you move to Muncie?
Yeah, we moved to Muncie. We left, which is funny. I studied animation, and then right away, I leave and go to Muncie to work for a syndicated cartoonist with no animation. But yeah, he moved us there, and God bless my wife. She took the leap of faith too. I mean, here she just graduated, and she said, "Let's do this. Let's see what happens." Fortunately, after a few months, Jim recognized her talent. You know, she was doing a little freelance for a little animation company called Four Star there in Indiana. Uh-huh. We did a couple of little commercials together. So she didn't really have a full-time job, but Jim recognized her talent, hired her. She started inking the strip for a little while, U.S. Acres, and then she quickly moved into licensing art and did tons of Garfield licensing art. So we're in this little bullpen together. There's Gary Barker, the guy who's drawing Garfield. It was this little split-level house. Vicky's next to me, Brett's to my left. And it was a really fun experience. And the great thing about it is Gary Barker had designed all the characters. And Jim let us slowly, if you look at the very first strips and look at the later ones, they got more cartoony and animated. And Jim really liked what we were doing. And we got to put a little more of our style. And they changed a lot. And then Brett started writing the strip with Jim. And they would kind of co-write together. And then I left the strip because Jim wanted to do some animation there, some of the Garfield stuff there. So I was really torn. Like, I'm missing animating. I want to animate. So he gave the strip to Brett full time, and Brett actually got to sign the strip near the last 6 months or whatever. So it was
Wow.
with Jim and Brett, and he did a great job with it. If anyone looks at the later ones, especially, I mean, it was all Gary's stuff was good as well, but it had that Brett style, which is, he's so funny with his drawings and everything. So yeah, that's the basic story of how.
And so you went into the animation side of the Garfield Productions, with Jim Davis, and you did some specials with Garfield.
Yeah. So what happened there is that Jim got really enamored with, he saw some of the CalArts student films. He saw, you know, he had seen mine and Vicky's and Brett's, which he thought was just fascinating. See pencil tests, like, wow, these kids who were practically kids then animated this stuff. Like, this is amazing. And then there was a tape of the entire year of one of the student shows. You know, they used to put them on tape. I had a VHS, mm-hmm. and we showed Jim some of the ones, and he just thought, well, we've got people that can animate here. Why don't we do a little bit of the animation for the next special here in Muncie? And so he hired a few other people, Ralph Eggleston, Doug Frankel, Wendell mm-hmm. Luby. They moved out for a short spell, and then I moved into animation. Vicky stayed in licensing, and then Brett actually eventually, yeah, he was gone. He moved back to California. He was drawing the strip from California. He moved back.
So why did he move back? Did he just want to be back in Southern California? Did he?
I think his wife wanted to be back there. I think Mona wanted to be in California. They just decided. Yeah, I think he wanted to be back there too. They both wanted to kind of go back. They missed California.
Yeah.
So they went back.
Tough winters in Muncie, huh?
Yeah, it's different. Although it's funny, Brett lives in Virginia now. So
wow.
He's lived there for years. He has a comic strip too that's actually syndicated in the paper, Diamond Lil, which is really funny. He does that full time. In addition to he still works for Jim, and he's still an assistant and helps write on the strip and everything.
So is Jim still doing the Garfield strip or?
Yes, that is. He sold the rights, but that's the one thing he's still doing.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the day to day, you know, dealing with licensees and all of that stuff.
He sold the business off, but he retained the strip.
Nickelodeon, from what I understand, Nickelodeon owns the character and the strip, and Jim is doing it for them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Something like that. And I don't know all the details, but that, I guess he's really happy. You know, he's kind of like not retired, but semi-retired in the sense that he's just focused on the strip now. And he has his team of people that he's worked with for years, and they're chugging along, and they're still making it, and it's still in a lot of papers apparently.
So when did you leave Muncie and come back to Los Angeles? Did you just sort of leave Jim Davis and come back and start to do animation here?
Yeah, we were there for about 2 years, and I missed animating after getting a taste of it again, working on the Garfield stuff. There was a special called Garfield, His Nine Lives. And that's the special that we got to work on. And what was neat about that is that there was a book that Jim did with his staff called Garfield, His Nine Lives. The special was an hour-long special. Each of the nine lives was going to be animated in a completely different style. So it was perfect for something that could be done, you know, part of in Muncie, because it didn't have to match anything Film Roman was doing. Mm-hmm. So I think there were three or four of the lives that we got to do, and there's one that I got to design and direct in my own style. It was called Court Musician. Jim wrote it. I mean, all the voice work and music was done with Film Roman. We got the soundtrack, but we got to actually animate the whole thing there. Wendell Luby painted the backgrounds. Wendell's an amazing designer, color person, you know, just art director. And he did all of that. And then we animated it. It was myself, Doug Frankel, and Ralph Eggleston did that one, and we all did the other ones together. So it was fun. We got to do different styles. And then Roger Rabbit came out, the Roger Rabbit movie. And we were just so excited about that, because here's like cartoony animation again, like really, you know, it wasn't Muppet Babies. It was like old fashioned.
It was sort of golden age, you know, of animation.
And I just, you know, I talked to friends back in LA and all the fun they were having on the stuff they were working on. And here I'd just gotten to do more animation with Jim. And I got this opportunity to work on Tummy Trouble, which I understand you worked on too.
I worked on that as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So I flew out to we decided to move back, and Jim was great about it. He was, you know, the strip was, Brett was finishing it up. I think it was done at that point. They decided to end the strip. It wasn't in as many papers as it had started, the US Acres.
Yeah.
So, so I went back, worked on that, and was fully back into animating. But then, of course, on the side, you know, doing my own strip and still had that.
And I was going to ask you, so you were still working on your own artwork, which I have to say, I really admire that. You know, Al John, I think, as an artist, when I started working at Disney, I had done a lot of dimensional, you know, sculpture work and stuff like that. And that kind of took a back seat. And actually, I hadn't done it for a number of years in the 1990s when we were in the thick of doing all of these movies at Disney. And then, you know, I've picked it back up, but I really admire people who actually can, you know, put in a 50-60 hour week on animation, you know, working on a movie, and then still find some creative juice left, to work on something like your comic strip. So how did your Bear and Me comic strip really start to come together for you?
That one came, so there was a long period where I did stop working on my own stuff. I just focused on animating. I'd gotten enough rejection letters that I was kind of frustrated, you know, just thought, well, maybe this isn't going to happen, and just kind of needed a break from it. Once my kids were born, my daughter kind of became an inspiration for Molly, different name and everything, but just when she got a little older, there's just a sweetness about her and a sort of a caretaker quality that she had that was really great. And I was always drawing bears for some reason. I just like cartoon bears, Yogi Bear, Baloo the Bear, you know. Sure. So I would always just draw various cartoon bear characters. And one day I was sketching and I was drawing a little girl to kind of look similar to her. And the bear on the page was very scared looking. And the girl looked calm and confident, and there was just a combination there that seemed kind of fun. And then I decided, well, I'm going to kind of pick it up again. I wanted to do some newer strips.
It's a nice contrast, by the way, you know, between this large bear and this sweet little girl.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with comedy, it's like, as you know, it's like contrasts are always, always great to play for comedy. So I started sending that around after I did. Usually you would do like a couple weeks worth of strips to send around to different syndicates. And LA Times syndicate, I actually got a phone call. I was working for Daryl Van Sitters at the time, working at their Warner Brothers unit. We worked on a short called Box Office Bunny. And mm-hmm. I love working with Daryl and
Renegade Productions, Daryl Van Sitters production company. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've worked on his Tom and Jerry show a bit too. So I got a phone call, and the guy at LA Times Syndicate, which I don't think there is an LA Times Syndicate that does comics anymore. They had a few strips. He liked my stuff. He thought it was funny and liked the characters, and he wanted to see more. Usually that's the next step. They want to see more to see if you can continue with that. Mm-hmm. But he said, I think it should be a dog, not a bear. Because kids, kids are going to relate to a dog more. And I thought, dog, I like it being a bear. I felt that was what was fun about it. So I gave it a try, and I called it Molly and the Dog. I did a whole new submission. He said, you don't have to do them finished ink strips. I know you can draw. I just want to see your writing. So I did them the way we did when I was working for Jim, little Xerox out 4-panel blank panels. And I just write new strips and thumbnail them out as a dog. And I sent it back to him, thinking, well, maybe I'm getting close. Maybe this is it. And he said, you know, seeing it with a dog, I think you're right. I think it's better as a bear, but I think we're going to pass anyway. So I went through that hoop of doing the, for whatever reason, I can't remember what his reasoning was at the time, but I'd say that's the closest I got to a newspaper syndication. There was one guy that was great. Jay Kennedy was the editor for King Feature Syndicate for a long time.
Which really was the pinnacle, wasn't it? I mean,
yes.
King, if yeah. you got into King Features, I mean, they had all the great comic strips, didn't they?
Yeah, all the classic comic strips that you think of, Blondie and Dagwood.
Wizard of Id? Was it Wizard of Id?
I'm not sure if that one was them or not, but they have stuff now that they didn't have in the past, like Dennis the Menace and,
sure.
you know, Popeye and all that stuff. Yeah, so that was exciting. He actually wrote, it was a form letter, but he actually wrote, there was a strip I did about these two alien characters that I'd sent, and he wrote in the corner a little critique, and that was nice. It was like, wow, he actually hand wrote this critique. Come to find out, he did that for a lot of people that he thought had potential. He was just this really nice guy and very encouraging, and yeah. you know, say send more stuff. And that strip never went anywhere, but that was kind of nice. But other than that, this was with LA Times was the closest thing.
Yeah. So you're working in animation and you're still working on this Bear and Me comic strip, on your own time.
Yeah.
What was the next sort of jump for you on that strip? How did you get it out there and start building a fan base?
Well, I finally realized, you know, that people were putting their stuff on the internet, which I had never done. People had blogs and people were showing their artwork, and this would have been around 1999, 2000. No, it was actually later than that. I was working on the strip and sending it out, took a long break from it, but then it was later that I thought, oh, I'm going to try to put it on some site. And at the time, I don't know if they do it now, but Go Comics, which is Universal Press Syndicate, they syndicated Calvin and Hobbes and mm-hmm. a bunch of Doonesbury was their very first strip. They started the syndicate for that strip. They had a site called Comic Sherpa. And for a really small fee, you could anybody could post a strip. And so there are a lot of amateur cartoonists, some people who are professionals just wanting to get syndicated, could post it on there. And after a short time, they bumped me up to actually Go Comics, where I was part of the syndicated roster of strips, only web-based though. Some of those are newspaper and web, but there's a lot of strips on Go Comics that are only on the web. And what's great about that, I felt like I'm kind of syndicated. I am syndicated, not in the newspaper, but I've got a real syndicate that, you know, also distributes it to other newspaper sites. Like for a while, it was part of the Daily News and different
websites. But are they digital publications or actual newspaper, hard copies?
No, they're not. So they buy a package from Go Comics, from Universal Press. For instance, if it's the New York Daily News, and just their website will have 50 strips or whatever. And mine is part of that package for various newspapers, nice. But not in the print edition, only the web. So it's a way sure. for them to have comic strips. So let's say you go to your favorite newspaper website, you don't read the paper anymore, they'll have a comic section. Mm-hmm. And you can read Garfield, Peanuts, whatever, and obscure ones, and some, you know, something like mine that's obscure as well. So that's where it started to get where people know about it a little bit.
And on the animation side, you switched from your day job. You were doing animation, but you've moved right. into storyboarding, which seems like a very natural evolution of you as an animation artist to go into storyboarding, because you've been doing these comic strips at night and on weekends.
Yes. Yeah. And I missed drawing, and that's why I wanted to go into story. I actually got hired the first storyboarding. I mean, I did some storyboarding throughout my career for different things, like some of the Garfield specials and the thing I directed, but I never considered myself a board artist. You know, it was something I dabbled in here and there just from working at different studios. But I went to Pixar because I had friends up there that had animated they were traditional animators, but they liked to draw still. Mm-hmm. And they encouraged me to submit my stuff up there. Because, you know, you still get to draw. And I thought, well, that, you know, things are slowly kind of going towards computers. that could be a way to continue to draw. So I submitted my stuff. So I went up there in 1999, and the first film I worked on was Monsters Incorporated. Mm. I got to board on that, and Joe Ramft was fantastic because I had never really boarded. So they paired me with him for the first month or so.
You couldn't get any better than that. I mean, Joe Ramft was a once in a generation story artist, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and such a nice guy. I mean, everybody who ever knew him. You know, I've never heard a bad thing about the guy. He was just wonderful.
Amazing, amazing talent. And by the way, I just want to interject here. Our friend Al John, John Canemaker, who was a guest on our show a few months ago, John Canemaker wrote a fantastic book called The Two Joes.
I've seen it, yeah.
About Joe Grant and Joe Ramft.
Yeah,
and it's really a must read for anybody who's interested in animation and understanding some of the artists behind it. Joe Grant was, you know, the guy behind. I mean, he was an incredible story guy, but you know, he goes back to the Dumbo and you know the 1940s or 1950s of Walt Disney Studios, and then you've got Joe Ramft, who is of our generation. You know, the 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Yes. Yeah. And Joe, I knew him a little bit. I'd met him a few times here and there, it might have been probably with Daryl Van Sitters, because I think he came by and had lunch a couple of times. So he knew who I was a little bit. I knew him and he knew my student films. He was just so encouraging. And I remember the first boards I did, we took a sequence together. And he gave me a little section and he boarded the other part. And I remember showing him my first boards. I showed him to pitch them. I pinned them up. You know, they were actual drawings back then. And he just looked at it and he paused for a minute. He goes, I can tell you're an animator. And I'm thinking, maybe this is a compliment. I don't know. And he said, you like close-ups. You like to draw the character. And he was right. I looked at it from a distance and I saw, I don't have any establishing shots, or if I do, there's barely any, because I was used to drawing the character and not really thinking about the background.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, you could be a great animator and then, you know, completely fall on your face as a board artist, because board artists have really special skills. You have to not only be able to draw the characters, but you have to do composition. You have to know cinematography and cutting. And
yes.
Just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I was not one of the people that looked at that as much as I did love like Spielberg films. I loved Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I did do my own Super 8 films. And I think looking back on them, you know, they had some pretty good shots. But for some reason, when you start to draw, it's almost like it took me a long time to even understand it. I don't know. I just really... just took me a while to get comfortable and feel like I knew what I was doing. To think of the cutting and having to really watch a film and think about, you know, I know there's people that they just naturally had an affinity for that. And they were already watching films that way who went into storyboarding, but I was always looking at the acting or the entertainment and the business of what the animation was doing, or even live action, you know, the acting and that sort of thing. I wasn't thinking of the shots as much. So that was a new thing for me, but slowly you start to understand it. And a person like Joe is a great teacher, and just, it's like everything. You just keep doing it. And
sure.
Eventually
I have no doubt that Joe Ramft was really encouraging and really just gave, he was the kind of guy I think that would be able to guide an artist gently. Just a gentle guiding hand without being intimidating, but rather being really helpful with pointing out how to improve and what you need to do.
Absolutely. I mean, a perfect example is the story I told you where he said, you like to draw the character. You like close-up. It didn't feel like a mean, like someone else could have said that, like, oh, well, you got too many close-ups. What are you doing here? You know, and you'd feel terrible. But by saying it the way he did, it made sense. I saw it immediately. It didn't feel like he was mad at me or, you know, I didn't done something stupid or, you know, he acknowledged, well, you're an animator. This is what you're seeing. And I think that was a great approach for me. It helped me learn better than if someone had been, you know, maybe hard on me. And I couldn't have asked for a better director to work with too, for the first time in story. Pete Docter's just a great guy. And he liked my stuff and knew my stuff before that. And, you know, was just easy. He's an easy guy to talk to. You're not afraid of intimidated by him, but yet he's super talented.
Yeah. I mean, he's a grounded individual and just a real nice guy and knows his stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And boy, his student films. I don't know if you ever saw his stuff. He pencil test stuff he did for Cal Art.
No.
There's such a charm to it. They're 2D. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of like the stuff he's making now is still, you see Pete in that, you know, his personality and who he is.
Well, I mean, just look at Soul.
Yeah.
The latest one, which by the way, Al John, I did watch.
Did you like it? Of course.
I did. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Everybody texts me and says, man, this movie is, you've got to watch it. And of course, all my musician friends are like, it made me cry. And of course, I don't think you have to be a musician for the movie to move you.
No, it's got a big heart to it. The film does. But are you doing primarily, Bob, are you primarily doing storyboarding now?
I am. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just finished on a film, actually Mark Dindal's directing.
Oh, okay.
Garfield, all animated Garfield, not the like hybrid ones, but so my career's kind of come full circle, which is fun doing Garfield again, but it's very cartoony. Looks, you know, how you've seen him before.
So Nickelodeon's doing a Garfield feature.
It's actually Alcon is doing.
Oh, okay. It.
Alcon's bought the rights to do animation before the rights were sold.
Oh,
Nickelodeon. Okay. So they're doing it right now. Mark's directing it, and I love working with Mark. I worked with him on Cat Stone Dance, and mm-hmm. I mean, we love the same kind of animation and cartoony type stuff. And so that's been really just a blast to work on. I mean, just awesome. Really fun to draw the characters and again, you know, Mark's fun. It's fun coming with gags and story ideas, and he's very much into the fun cartoony, like I said, type of animation. I mean, look at Emperor's New Groove, you know, that's Mark's humor.
And of course,
I love that stuff. Yeah. Which is amazing coming from a guy who was an effects artist.
Is this a full feature, Bob? Is this a 90?
Yeah, 90 it'll be minute? It's a full animated feature.
That's great.
Story. We pretty much finished with story and yeah, they're still going forward. Awesome. With stuff.
And is that
going
to be a theatrical release?
I think that's the hope, you know,
yeah.
With everything today.
Well, I mean, say.
But yeah, that's what it's.
Pandemic aside.
Yes. that's the hope. And Alcon's done live action. That's their big thing. They did the Blade Runner movie and the Blind Side, the new Blade Runner. So this is their first foray.
Is this new Garfield movie, is it CG, the finished product? Is it a CG animated character or is it all hand-drawn? Yeah.
No, it's CG.
It's all CG. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't know if I should say much more. I'm not sure what.
Okay. Yeah. We don't want you to get into trouble.
I think everything I've said has been out there and announced.
Okay. Excellent.
That's cool. Cool.
So now, you know, getting back to your comic strip, you've been doing it for a number of years and you've got your first book coming out, which is a compilation of comic strips.
Actually, it's the second book.
Oh, it is the second one. Okay, my bad. All right.
Oh, that's okay. The first one was 2016.
Okay.
This is this will be the second one, and I've had enough strips for another one.
That's awesome. And this is with the same publisher?
No, this is actually a new publisher.
New
I was
publisher.
With Cameron and Company, which is a small publisher up in Northern California.
Uh-huh.
And they're distributed by Abrams now.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't have a deal to do another book, and they're not as much. They're a great publisher, but they don't publish very many cartoon books or comic strip books and that sort of thing. So on a whim, I contacted Hermes Press, which I love their books. And they do reprints of old comic strips. Uh-huh. They do the Phantom books. They do really nice archival books. They even have an Art of Garfield book where the strips are printed very big, the original strips and the blue line and everything. And they also do these Pogo comic strip books, a comic book, not the strips, but the reprints of the old Dell comics.
Sure, sure.
So I sent them an email. I'd sent to a bunch of different publishers, and Sabrina Herman is the person I sent to there. And she said, sure, send me your book. I'll take a look at it. And then usually I'm so used to everything just getting rejected or an email like, no, we're not interested. We're whatever. She emailed me right away and said, I'd like to talk. I want to set up a meeting with you and Dan Herman, who's the publisher, about publishing another book. So it went pretty quickly. The book would have been out earlier, would have been out last year. But with COVID, everything kind of got pushed back. Sure. But they moved pretty fast on it, and they were really happy to do it. So I feel fortunate that, you know, got another book, and the fact that it's being put out there by a publisher that knows that space and they're fans of comics. Yeah. And I mean, Dan is a huge fan of old Hanna-Barbera comic strips, like the ones that were done by, forget the artist, but there was a whole Flintstones comic strip in the 60s and a Yogi Bear one. They're beautifully drawn.
Yeah.
And he loves all that kind of stuff. So yeah, he was very encouraging and wanted to do it. So yeah, we're finally, it'll be out next month. I'm not sure the exact date. I kind of think it might get pushed back a little bit because it actually hasn't gone to the printer yet. So I'm wondering if it's could be a little bit later, but yeah. So.
And so this book will come out next month. Do you have plans on doing another one? I noticed, by the way, in this version, because Aljon and I have had a chance to read this and go through the comic strips and whatnot.
Yeah.
I noticed there's little use of color. There's some color in there, but not a lot. And I'm just wondering, is that by choice on your part? Or I know with regular comic strips, you know, like Monday through Saturday, it's usually black and white. And then the Sunday comics were always in color. But now with digital, everything could be in color if you want it to be.
Yeah, all the daily strips now are actually in color. If you go to, if you get a newspaper, they even color the old strips like Peanuts. The dailies are in color now. I don't have time to do it in color. So I only do it occasionally. And the spot color that you're talking about, I got that idea actually from Burke Breathed, who I saw, you know, he brought Bloom County back. And his daily strips were in black and white. But every once in a while, he'd, for a gag, you know, that he needed some color, he'd do a little bit of just a little spot color for something.
Which, by the way, I love. I noticed there was one strip where, Bear, his face goes red. And it really helped to punch the point that you were getting through in that panel. And then there was the little girl with the pink hair.
Yes. Yeah.
And she's kind of the artsy fartsy kind of friend of Molly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I liked the way Burke Breathed did that. And I thought, well, that's kind of neat. I'll do that once in a while. So I started doing that. And fortunately this book, the last book, had color front and back matter, but the middle was all black and white. There couldn't be any color, but they're able to do color in this book. So if I had colored it the entire book, they could have done it. So it's nice that the ones with the spot color and the occasional daily that I'll do in color will be in color.
The one thing I really liked was towards the end of the book, you have the process laid out. Yep. You have your sketch page of a comic strip idea, and then you've got the rough, pencil, the colored pencil drawing rough of it, and you step through the various parts of the process in getting a finished strip. I thought that was really a nice touch to have in the book and certainly inspiring to up and coming comic artists.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I remember the Charles Schulz book I told you about, and they, he showed the process in there. It was photos of him at his desk and a close-up of his hand. And I loved that as a kid. He even talked about what exact pen he used to ink with and everything. That was helpful and inspiring. So, and a lot of people ask me how I work. And most people work digitally now with their strips. There's still some that like Garfield used to be done on paper and ink. Now it's gone all digital. And a lot of strips have. So
everybody's using like a Cintiq tablet or something.
And I use a Cintiq, which is fantastic for, I'd use it for storyboarding. It's actually helped me with storyboarding because you can fix your shot, you know, and, you know, shrink something or make it bigger to kind of get your composition better. So I really like that.
You can cut and paste with it too. I mean, you can, you know, if you're doing four panels to depict the scene, you can cut and paste your background so that stays the same and then make the changes to the characters.
Exactly. Yeah. And because I've always done a strip this way, I just never stopped doing it that way. And I never thought it was that different or odd, but technology changed and the way people do strips changed. So I people are always interested in how that's done. So, so that's why that's there in the book. And it was great that Hermes wanted to do that kind of stuff. They gave me free rein pretty much and have been very supportive. And, in fact, Jim Davis does the foreword, which is really nice of him.
Yeah, I thought that was really terrific. It was a very nice foreword as well.
Yeah. So that was really nice. It was nice to reconnect with him a little bit on working on the Garfield movie.
And the book title is It's a Rough Day.
It's Been a Rough Day. Yeah.
It's Been a Rough Day is the full title from Hermes Press.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, where can people purchase the book? Because the publisher is accepting pre-orders. Is that right?
They are. Yeah. And actually it's everywhere. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Their distribution is everywhere. I've seen it on various sites like, you know, comic book shops in New York and those, it's everywhere. So
I think there's even a link.
You can get it from Hermes Press too. You can pre-order it there.
Yeah. You can even get, I think you have a link on your gocomics.com Bear With Me strip, so it's great. And I also wanted to give a shout out to your website, mollyandthebear.com, because you can also click the link and buy it there.
Yeah. So it's everywhere, which is great. Their distribution is huge. So
that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
And that's coming out at the end of January or beginning of February?
It's supposed to be February. I think end of February.
So, but it's available for pre-order now.
Yes.
And that's, it's Been a Rough Day, starring Bear and Molly comic strips, is it Bob Scott? Is that your art name or is it Robert Scott?
It's Bob. Yeah. I've always gone by Bob. All my credits, film credits, and my birth name is Robert, but nickname has been Bob. My dad was Robert, he's Bob, and so that I was Bobby when I was a kid.
There you go. All right.
Yeah, I think it's a great book because not only does it give it really cool insight to you and the creative process, as Dave mentioned, the strips are great. They're a lot of fun. I love the character study in the back, and the one thing the other thing that's a standout for me is the vintage look on the very back. You've got how the strips look from back in the day with all the vintage ads and everything and the cool patina for all the aged paper, it's just great. And
terrific.
Yeah. The three dimension look, we have to put on the 3D glasses. Cause Dave, you're amazing in the 3D realm. So the 3D glasses thing, I have to break out the 3D glasses for that third dimension.
It actually works too. And I just did it just for fun, not thinking it would work. And I had some old 3D glasses and I thought I put them on to see if it worked. It's like, it actually works.
Yeah,
I love it.
It absolutely does. One thing I did want to mention, Bob, is I really love the ink line on your comic strip, Bear and Me. or Bear With Me, excuse me. And I love the fact that there's a sort of a thick, thin line, which really, to me, when it's used appropriately, it makes the drawing sing. Visually, to me, it just takes the drawings over the top. And I really enjoyed looking at your comic strips because of that, because there's the use of that thick and thin ink line that just really adds dimension to the drawings.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say. I love inking. It's really, I started inking with a brush. I use a Winsor Newton back in college. I actually had a strip that I did on the side. Two of them printed in the Newhall Signal. Do you remember the Newhall Signal?
Absolutely. By the way, the Signal is still alive and well. It's hanging on by a thread, I think, but it still gets published up here.
Oh, that's great. They published my strip. It was called Myron. It was based on one of my student films. And twice a week. And I originally did it like Schultz with a dip pen. I used a C5. I actually got it wrong. He said that he did his strip with a certain kind of dip pen and he letters it with a C5. I got it wrong in my head and thought C5 was what he inked with. So I was actually learned how to ink with that pen, which was his lettering pen. And then I really liked Pogo and I loved Shu. And I read they were inked with a brush. So I started in college trying to ink with a brush and I've never gone back. Anytime I work on a strip, it's been a brush.
That's awesome.
Glad you mentioned
that. I actually wouldn't know how to ink that way in the computer. I've never learned how to ink in the computer.
To do a thick and thin line. Yeah.
Yeah. There's people who can do it beautifully, but yeah. I'm used to it this way. So I keep doing it. It's a little bit of extra work because you have to scan it, get rid of the blue line. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing is I can tweak things when I get it in there because there's always little surprises. I draw pretty large. Mm-hmm. When you see it smaller, it's like, oh, I drew that head just a little too small. I can just lasso it and blow it up. Little tweaks if I need to. And I hand letter it too.
I was going to say, shout out to the lettering because I love it. I absolutely love it. I was just looking, I was admiring the work about the Mickey Mouse operation that Costco, the Costco thing. It's like, what kind of Mickey Mouse operation are they running here? I've always wanted to say that at Disneyland.
Oh, thank you.
Like, it's really cool.
I'm not sure if everyone knows it, but
it's a great strip.
I read that comic strip as well, Al John, and I got a good laugh at it.
So did I. Because actually did that very same thing at Disneyland. It's like, what kind of Mickey Mouse operation is ready? I don't know if we want to get into this, Dave, but we have a listener who has a question.
Absolutely. Let's have the question.
Skull Rock Podcast answers your email.
All right. So top fan Spencer writes, can you please talk about what inspired your friend the Rat? Did the work of Ward Kimball heavily influence this short?
Oh, yes. So
that's to you, Bob.
Love it. That's to you.
Yes, Jim Capobianco, who directed that short, loves Ward Kimball, loves that style, and I do as well, and everyone who got to work on it loved that stuff too, and that was absolutely what Jim was doing, was like trying to do a Ward Kimball, 2D stylized, like those old things that he did for The Wonderful World of Disney. So, that was a lot of fun to work on. That's my favorite kind of animation to work on, anything like in that realm, cartoony.
So that whistle, toot, plunk, and boom kind of period.
Yeah, know, exactly.
Sort of going into that UPA style of the 50s.
Yeah, and Jim really wanted to do different styles for each little segment. Mm-hmm. So there's even a little stop motion segment. And there's, cut paper looking stuff and some of it's After Effects and hand drawn.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that. Dead on. That's exactly what we were going for.
That's my wife, Kristen. Yeah. That's one of her favorite characters. Actually, it's her favorite character is Remy and Emil. And, so she's super stoked. She's like, oh, I can't wait. You know, this is really cool. The other thing I'd like to mention too, is you mentioned Preston Blair earlier in the show. And I know that, there is a lot of the MGM work that he did. How influential was, maybe some of the stuff he did with the bear and the bean, or the bear and the hare, those kind of things, and influenced, your strip? Cause it seems like, it seems very, very cool that it's almost like an homage.
Yeah, not necessarily consciously, but definitely bear, because any bear character, I don't know why, but I just love the designs of those Disney bears, like Humphrey the Bear and Yogi Bear, of course, Hanna-Barbera. And there's something about a bear that's like a giant stuffed animal that's appealing, you know, imagining having a bear as a friend. I think I loved Jungle Book as a kid too for that. It's like, wow, what if this was your best friend? This guy's so amazing and cool and... that stuff definitely influenced me.
We have a question from Jeff, and he asks, so how did you get into doing your voices or being part of additional voice casting for these Pixar films?
Well, that's a really cool thing that at Pixar at the time, and I think they're still doing it probably. Usually the scratch is done by story artists or animators that they think are able to do that sort of thing. And so I got called in to do some scratch when I was on Monsters, not thinking it would even be used, but they actually ended up using the scratch. They kept it in there for a couple voices that I did, just quick lines. But that just kind of happened. You know, I did a lot of acting as a kid and was in plays and that sort of thing. So that was fun.
And is that something you're pursuing at all? Or is it just one of those, you kind of do it here and there when the opportunities present themselves?
Yeah. Just if the opportunity presents itself. Usually I get to do scratch on pretty much everything I work on at some point, like even Garfield, I've done a little scratch, and I don't think anything will be used in that, but it's always fun to do. Yeah. It's just, it's fun to have that as a creative outlet. And what I like about it too is like I prefer not to be on camera, you know, doing a voice. So that's what's great. You can act, but you don't have to be.
You're not self-conscious that somebody's actually going to be showing this.
Yeah, they'll never see it.
Of people.
We have
being on camera is very self. I'm very self-conscious, but.
Oh man, no! Don't be. You're a lot of fun. We have a last question here. We've got one from Deanna, and she's asking, which one of the Pixar film characters is your favorite, if you had to choose one?
Does she mean that I've
favorite
worked
that
on?
You worked on. Favorite that you worked on, yes.
That I worked on?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Off the top of my head, I might say Jack-Jack. That one just pops to mind because I really, that was a fun character to animate, and I love the design of the character, and babies are just fun to you know, they're just always funny and cute. And I remember some of the old Hanna-Barbera cartoons when they had a baby character. There was one in Yogi Bear.
Yes.
And they're just, the design is always fun. And so, yeah, I'd say Jack-Jack. That would be the one that off the top of my head that I like.
that's our little boy's nickname because he kind of looks like Jack-Jack. So there you go.
Oh, that's perfect. Awesome. Yeah.
It's perfect. Well, yeah, that's great.
I got to board a lot with that character and then animate on that. I did both. I computer animated as well on that. So that was fun.
Wonderful work. It's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bob Scott, what a career. I mean, you know, animator at Disney, at Pixar, storyboard artist, and the comic strip Bear With Me. And you can catch a whole bunch of those comic strips in It's Been a Rough Day from Hermes Press. That's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, I'm sure Books A Million, anywhere you purchase your books. And as I always like to say, Al John, if you have a local independent bookstore in your community, they can get those books for you. They can order Bob Scott's It's Been a Rough Day. And when it comes in, you can do a curbside pickup.
There you go.
More than likely.
Yeah.
pandemic is over.
There you go.
I know, gosh.
Bob, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate you coming on the show. It was really a fun hour of chatting with you.
Oh, I had a great time. It's really fun. It'd be fun just to talk off off the podcast and just keep talking.
But, yeah, just being with human beings. Yeah, just interacting with humans.
I absolutely, we wish you the best of luck with the release of your second Bear With Me book.
Yeah.
Which is a compilation of your comic strips. It's coming out in February, again, from Hermes-Press. Hermes-Press.com. You can pre-order the book there or wherever you purchase your books. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much. It was really nice.
Skull Rock Podcast, your weekly dose of pixie dust.
I love that interview. What a great guy Bob is.
He really is. And you know, the comic strip itself is really quite funny. I mean, I really enjoyed reading, you know, we had the advanced PDF of his book that's coming out in February. So it was really fun going through that book and reading the comic strip. As I said in the interview, I love his drawing style.
Man, it's great.
I love the way he inks that comic strip.
You know, you say things, Dave, that in your world, in your realm of animation and how you studied, makes great sense, because the lettering, I made mention of it, or the type of inking that he does. I think it's wonderful. Absolutely love it, because those are things I haven't thought about in quite some time. And as I mentioned in our pre-interview, I was a big fan of Bloom County, big fan of Opus, that character. And, would go down to Walden Books and oftentimes buy up these compendiums, you know, my favorite comics and my favorite comic strips. And so the Garfields and then the Opuses and the Bloom County and all that stuff, Calvin and Hobbes were some of my favorites. And I just love that style, because it harkens back to that style that we love, you know, the Nancy cartoon strips and the different things that we've grown up with over the years. So, wonderful.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the final book coming out,
yeah.
Which again is titled It's Been a Rough Day, featuring Bear With Me comic strips by Bob Scott. And Aljon, you're going to get the links up on for HermesPress.com and all of that.
Yep, we'll have the links.
People can get that book, because it's really a terrific book. It's one of those things where it just brightens your day reading a comic strip, I think, you know. Those kinds of books are wonderful, because you can pick it up and you could read a comic strip or two, have a little bit of a laugh, put the book aside, and do the same every day. And give yourself a little laugh each day, especially
exactly.
Now. I mean, with the craziness of this pandemic, we all deserve to have a little bit of a laugh here and there when we can get it.
Absolutely. So we'll have those links in there for everyone to check out. And don't forget, gang, I know if you're just finding us for the very first time in this new year, you're looking for something to listen to, thank you for subscribing. I hope you subscribe and tell your friends. And we would appreciate if you give us a like, you throw up a review on iTunes or Spotify or Anchor, wherever you find our podcast, we would appreciate it. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or LinkedIn on the case of Dave and myself. And you can also email us as well, Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com, or Dave at skullrockpodcast.com. And Dave, we have such a great year. I know that you're working on a bunch of stuff behind the scenes in terms of your friends getting on the show, but what kind of final words do you have for us this week?
Well, you know, something I did want to mention as the new year starts, and this is our first show of 2021, but it's hard to believe Disneyland has been closed for more than 200 days.
Oh my gosh.
Can you imagine that? More than 200 days, and we don't know when they're going to reopen. I mean, I hope they open by March or April or May. I mean, hopefully there's going to be a summer at Disneyland.
I hope so. You know, and we're nearing the anniversary there at Walt Disney World as well for next year.
Yeah, the 50th anniversary
of
Walt Disney World.
Yeah, I'm hoping, yeah.
Hey, listen, in the interim, and I'm going to give a shameless plug to my book, 3D Disneyland,
yes.
Like you've never seen it before. If you if you're just really missing the park, grab a copy. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. I know Vrahman's bookstore in Pasadena here in Los Angeles is carrying the book. And of course, your local bookstore. If you can, support your local bookstore. They can order these books in if they don't have them in stock. It'll take a couple days, but they'll have it. You can do a drive-by pickup, curbside pickup. You can get not only my books there, but you can get Bob Scott, It's Been a Rough Day.
Yes.
So check it out if you can. And that's all I got, Al John.
Oh, that's great.
Until next week.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a quick plug, too. If you're just finding us for the first time, don't forget to check out my other podcast, The Disney List. You can also check out the Dining at Disney podcast and all of our friends at Sorcerer Radio who happily promote Dave and my podcast, as well at srsounds.com. First fan run and the only fan run Disney station that's out there that has been around since 2001. So we've been around for a long time. So we appreciate the support and of you guys promoting Skull Rock Podcast. So thank you so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care. And we'll see you next week.
Have a great week. Boom. Now, can we do a little 20-second thing? Just you and I banter a little bit. It's for the Sweet Spot. They're celebrating their 300th podcast. And, you know, Lynn reached out to me, and I want us to do it, the two of us. And then if you can send it to me as an MP3 file.
I'm Al John Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they'd want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.